Imagine the response you'd get if you asked a sampling of Americans aged 16 to 60 the following question. What was the significance of World War I and its impact on America? Thousands of books and History Channel programs have been devoted to the greatest generation and the experience of World War II, while the veterans of World War I, which was called the Great War at the time, lived among us and often died in obscurity. Richard Rubin spent years researching, tracking down, and interviewing the last living American veterans of the so-called War to End All Wars and documenting their stories for his new book called The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten War. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought Richard Rubin back to our show. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Haven't seen you for a while. Were you working on this book all that time? Was it, 11 years?
10 years on this book, yeah.
The amount of legwork, research, and sleuthing involved it's fascinating to me, but it must have been grueling to you. What got you started on this project?
It was early 2003, and I was supposed to be working on a completely different book. I was procrastinating one day, listening to the radio, and somebody came on to talk about World War II and that generation. And he said in a very urgent tone of voice that World War II veterans were dying off at the rate of 1,000 a day, and that we must get their stories now while we still can. And, of course, I couldn't agree with that more, but for some reason that day I thought, what about World War I? I'd heard lots of World War II stories, but very few World War I stories. And I did the math in my head. It was exactly 85 years since the armistice, and I figured somebody who was 20 in 1918 would be 105 in 2003. And I thought, well, there won't be many, but maybe there'll be two or three.
Do you think the reason we haven't gotten more is because there was such a short span between World War I and World War II? We've had a long time after World War II, despite the fact that World War and also World War II is a lot clearer kind of bad guy, good guy kind of war.
Well, that's true. You know, we weren't attacked in World War I like we were in World War II, and World War II did follow World War I exactly a generation afterwards. So if you think about it, maybe the shelf life of that war sort of at the forefront of our national memory would have been exactly a generation long. But beyond that, these weren't the type of people who sought the limelight. They grew up in a time very different from ours. They grew up without electricity and automobiles, without antibiotics, without any of the medication really that we take for granted. In small towns, many of them never expected to leave the county in which they'd been born throughout their entire lives. And I don't think they were comfortable really being in the forefront.
Well, it's often said that World War II veterans are reluctant to talk about their war experiences. What about these people? I mean, they knew that they didn't have much longer to live. Pretty much everybody they had known and grown up with was dead already.
That's true. And I think that actually worked to my benefit. I think if I had sought these people out 20, 30 years earlier, they might have been very reluctant to speak. One thing that I heard from a lot of them was that they were telling me stories that they hadn't told in 50, 60, 70 years.
Although they had to remember them, and age sometimes causes problems with memories.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting thing that I learned while doing this. Centenarians are not like the rest of us, and their memories don't work the way the rest of our memories do. When you get to be that age, if you're still sharp, it's really a matter of first in, last out. They could remember very, very clearly things that they had done 80, 90, even a century earlier, but often not so clearly what they'd had for breakfast that day.
Certain memories seem to have crystallized for these people. I'm thinking of your interview with William Lake and his vivid description of sitting next to a soldier who was shot by sniper fire.
Yeah, well, I imagine that's the kind of thing that you might never forget as much as you might want to. He was he got to that early in our visit, our first visit, and he returned to it often. He was one day in the fall of 1918. This was during the Battle of Meuse-Argonne, which was the last great battle of the war, and in fact the costliest battle in American history before or since. He was sitting on a dirt bank near a trench talking to a friend maybe 2 feet away, and a German sniper shot and killed the man. And it was obvious in talking to him that it was still a very emotional experience for him, not just the loss of his friend, but the thing he kept getting back to again and again about it was he, that is the German sniper, he picked him instead of me. He felt that his life had come down to a coin toss, and he carried that around for 85, 86 years.
Mm. Do you think he talked about it with other people?
I don't think he did. He was one of the people who told me that these were things that he hadn't shared in a long time. And when I asked him why not, he said something that other people said to me too, which is that nobody had asked in that long.
Really? Because I know I've spoken to people who've served in the war, and I've asked them about their war experiences, and they usually give you a brief answer, and they want to move on.
Well, maybe a lot of people figured that this was something he wouldn't have wanted to talk about. I can't say, but I can tell you he lived in Yakima, Washington, which is a good-sized town but not a huge town, and he was almost 108 years old when I met him, and yet almost nobody in Yakima seemed aware of this man's existence, and he'd lived there for 75 years. I would think that if a small town or a medium-sized town somewhere had a 108-year-old man who'd been a veteran of World War I, there'd be a statue of the man in the town.
My guess is Richard Rubin, whose latest book is The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How many U.S. veterans of World War I were still living when you began?
Well, that was a very hard figure to get a handle on. There was this actuary table at the VA's, the Department of Veterans Affairs website, that said in 2003, 1,500. And it became clear very early on that that was not the case. I would say fewer than 100 for sure, maybe 4 or 5 dozen at the most.
And how many of those were you able to locate and interview?
I interviewed a total of about 36 men and women. Mm-hmm. Not all of them made it into the book, and some of them, their status as World War I veterans is a little disputed. There's one story I tell in the book of a gentleman who was told to report to the train station in Binghamton, New York, to head out for camp, and he gets on the train and sits down and is issued a blanket and a pair of Army wool socks, and then an officer comes on the train and tells him that they should all go home. The armistice has just been signed. So is he a World War I veteran? It's hard to say.
What about the women? What roles did they serve? Mostly nurses?
No. Actually, I was not able to interview any nurses. Two of the three women I interviewed were actually what were known then as yeomanettes. They served in uniform in the United States Navy, and it was the first time that women served in uniform in any branch of the military. The program was actually created by a clerical error in a Naval Act of 1916, which didn't specify what gender enlistees had to be. And the third was a woman from the Bronx. She'd been an 18-year-old secretary at Funk and Wagnalls in 1917 when her boss told her to go take a civil service exam. And the next thing she knew, she got a telegram at 1 o'clock in the morning ordering her to report to the War Department in D.C. on December 17th. And she called them up and asked them if she could wait a week until after Christmas, and they said no.
Now, you can't – in 2003, I guess, you couldn't Google – World War One veterans still living, could you?
Well, actually, Google was very helpful to me through their search function that they do every day. I plugged in phrases like World War One veteran, oldest living veteran, veteran of the First World War, and every once in a while, an article in some small town newspaper would pop up, and that's how I found some of the people. But it wasn't just as easy as typing in World War One veteran.
I'm assuming a few of them were suffering from Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia that are associated with old age?
A few were, but surprisingly few. As I said before, centenarians are not like the rest of us. And the things that will take down the rest of us, be they physical ailments or something like dementia, don't afflict them in the numbers that they afflict the rest of us.
Well, the last World War One American vet died in 2011, didn't he?
That's right, Frank Buckles. He was 110 years old.
Had you been able to speak to all the people you'd planned to by that time, 2011?
He was the last living American World War I veteran for something like 3 years. You ask if I'd spoken to everybody I'd planned to. When I set out, I thought I might find two or three. So actually, I was lucky beyond my wildest imagination when I started out. But there was a certain point around 2006 when it became apparent that I knew who all these people were and where they were, and there weren't going to be any new interview subjects.
Do you think that the veterans of World War I were quite different than the veterans of World War II because of the nature of the wars? World War I was largely a trench war, whereas World War II was more of a position war, and then the wars that have followed have been totally different from anything World War I was.
I would say that for the veterans, it wasn't the actual nature of warfare itself that made the experience different for them, but the nature of the enemy. Again, in World War II, we were attacked at Pearl Harbor, and then in Europe with the Nazis, you really had a sense that you were facing down metaphysical evil. And one thing that I found with the World War I veterans I interviewed was that they didn't have any particular hatred or even dislike of the Germans they were fighting. There were many stories of pleasant interactions with German POWs, some of whom had lived and worked in the United States for quite a few years before the war and spoke perfectly unaccented English.
But there was a lot of anti-German feeling. I remember reading that you couldn't call pickled cabbage sauerkraut for a while, and all sorts of German words were eliminated from the language. And my grandfather, who thought of himself as a German, got into a lot of trouble because his loyalties weren't always as clear as they might have others might have wanted them to be.
That's true. Sauerkraut was renamed Liberty Cabbage for the duration of the war, and fortunately that didn't survive the war.
Neither did Freedom Fries
Freedom
survive
fries, yes.
The Iraq War.
That lived a few more years than Liberty Cabbage. Yes, there was terrible, terrible anti-German prejudice in this country during the First World War.
More than World War II in an odd way, I would think.
Yes, I would say that's true. Interestingly enough, of course, German Americans were welcome in the army, as were immigrants from the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was still a thriving concern at that time, and our enemy. But there were two acts passed, Espionage and Sedition Acts during World War I that really not only cracked down on opposition, outspoken opposition to the war, but also sort of created an atmosphere that was quite fearful for people, not just German immigrants, but people of German descent who'd been in this country for 200 years.
When you were writing about that, did you think much about the revival of the Espionage Act in recent years after being in obscurity for so long?
It's chilling. Actually, how the extent to which history repeats itself. Reading about that for the first time some years ago, the parallels to modern day were really, really quite striking.
Your subtitle is The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. Did the people you talked to feel that they had been forgotten?
I would say no, but largely because it wasn't in their nature to feel that way, to experience that kind of grievance. But as I said, most of them lived in small towns surrounded by neighbors who were completely unaware of their existence, which is very difficult, I think, to picture for veterans of World War II, thankfully. But they never expressed any kind of ill feeling about the fact that World War I has largely been forgotten in this country and that their service has also largely been forgotten.
Well, there were a lot of books initially. All Quiet on the Western Front, for example, was amazing. There were a lot of war movies that Hollywood did, but so many of them were silence, and perhaps that's another reason that it stopped being in the American consciousness.
I think so. I mean, of course, All Quiet on the Western Front is a German novel that was translated into
English.
It was made into a wonderful movie here in America several times, actually.
And it was banned. Did you know that it was banned in Hitler Germany because And that was, there's a new book about Hollywood and World War II, and they caved in to the Nazi demands on what was acceptable and what wasn't.
Well, it's not surprising when you see that movie that it would be unacceptable to the Third Reich, you know, just the anti-war sentiments that it expresses. The top grossing film of 1941 was Sergeant York, and Gary Cooper won an Oscar for his portrayal of that character.
But perhaps that was because we were on the cusp of going into another war with Germany.
I think that's true. Another movie from that that period, I don't know if it's 41 or 42, is Yankee Doodle Dandy, which is a biopic about George M. Cohan, which ends with soldiers marching through the streets singing Over There.
Although Wings, I think, was the first Academy Award winner, and that was about the Flyers during World War One.
That's right.
Did you speak to – where did most of these people serve?
I would say most of them served in the infantry, in the Army. I did interview more than half a dozen naval veterans and a couple of Marines. I think you were about to ask me about aviators. The closest I got to an aviator was a gentleman named Homer Anderson, who'd grown up in Pennsylvania and served in the Balloon Corps in World War One, which is a wonderful little forgotten footnote of that war.
And that they would do surveillance of enemy lines.
That's right. You'd go up in a hot air balloon and look out over the front. And it was terribly dangerous duty. You were utterly defenseless up there.
Richard Rubin's book, The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War, is published by Harcourt. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Richard Rubin, whose previous book was the best-selling Confederacy of Silence. Now, The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You devote an entire chapter to the last night of World War One. What makes that night so different from all other nights?
The story that I tell in the book is of a gentleman named George Bryant, who was a 16-year-old Cajun from New Orleans when he managed to convince the 3rd Field Artillery, the 76th Field Artillery, to let him enlist.
Despite being 16.
He was 16 and looked it, and he was turned away many times before somebody finally let him enlist. And he was very badly wounded in July of 1918 and managed to convince doctors to send him back to his unit just in time to see the end of the war. And on the last night of the war, several men from his battery took shelter in a patch of woods sort of on the edge of a forest. And the Germans knew that people would be there, and they targeted it with artillery, and those men were all killed. And George Bryant found their bodies very shortly thereafter. And he, in recounting this to me 86 years later, broke down sobbing, terribly emotional. And it was really the only time in hundreds of hours of conversations I had that this happened. These men, by and large, were very, very stoic. But I think what got him was not that these men had been killed, fine, handsome young men as he described them, but that they had died so close to the end of the war. If you think about it, what other war in history do we know the precise instant at which it ended? And thus, as tragic as any death is in a war, to find out that your son or brother was killed with just hours to go in that war, I think really compounds the tragedy. It certainly did for him.
And then, as we mentioned earlier, William Lake lived with the guilt of having been not the one who was killed by a sniper. But you have a number of really funny stories in this book as well. Can tell us about Arthur Fiala, how his lack of French didn't stop him from eating in a small mountain village.
Well, he really had a great time in the war, if you can say that. He was from a small town in Wisconsin, Kewaunee, went and enlisted. Really, he was very honest because he was looking for a job. And they put him in the 20th Engineers, which was this enormous regiment composed largely of lumberjacks. Their job was to provide timber for the American Expeditionary Forces. And he just had a really good time. He got very sick, almost died at one point, but but he said that one day he wandered into a French village, and it was like a scene out of Brigadoon. The girls were wearing wooden shoes and carrying yokes with pails of milk, and people kept cows in their houses on the other side of a partition from the kitchen. And he said one time he and a couple of friends went into a cafe to get something to eat, and they didn't. None of them spoke any French, so they just sat down at a table and started clucking like chickens. And he said, and that's how they knew we wanted eggs. And I said, well,
they could have wanted chicken.
I said to him, well, what if they brought you chicken instead? He said, well, that would have been all right, too.
We're talking about a war that began less than 50 years after the Civil War ended. What was the situation for African Americans?
Oh, it was very bad. This was not only 50 years after the Civil War ended, but 20 years after Plessy v. Ferguson, the Supreme Court decision in 1896 that essentially repealed all of the rights that were granted to African Americans under the 13th, 14th, and well, not the 13th, but the 14th and 15th Amendments. Lynchings were at an all-time high, and the Army had serious debates about whether or not to allow African Americans to enlist, and once they were allowed to enlist, what to do with them. There was very strong feeling that among top brass in the Army that they should not be allowed to fight at all.
Well, were they? Did they feel a certain loyalty? After all, one of the men you talked to was the son of slaves.
That's right. Not only the son of slaves, but his parents were fully grown adults when they were emancipated. I think they did. I think that they felt like E.B. Du Bois famously said at the time, if this is our country, this is our war. I think that many of them saw this as an opportunity to step up and prove that they were worthy of the freedoms that the Constitution promised them.
That man, Moses Hardy, was 112 when you met him in Aberdeen, Mississippi. What was your time with him like?
He was a really remarkable man in many ways. I never saw him standing up or even sitting up. Every time I went to visit him, and I saw him several times, he was flat on his back. And the first time I was there, there was nobody there from his family to sort of furnish the introduction. I don't think he knew what I was doing there. And he was a bit wary, but he warmed up to me, and he answered every question I posed to him. Every time I would ask him, are you getting tired? Do you need to stop? He'd say, no. Another one of these people who felt that nothing was really ever hard for him.
He was a member of the Pioneer Infantry.
That's
right. Was
that
a segregated unit?
Well, yes. It was like all so-called colored units at the time. The enlisted men were black and the officer corps were white. But Pioneer Infantry were special because they were armed. The vast majority of African-American troops in World War I were in what was known as Service of Supply, or SOS. They weren't issued any weaponry at all. Pioneer Infantry were combat engineers who worked very close to the front. And so they were armed. They were issued rifles. And those rifles meant a tremendous amount to these men.
Now, after World War II, a lot of returning African-American vets were outraged by the fact that they had fought for the country and now they had to deal with Jim Crow. What about the people like Hardy who returned to an even tougher situation in 1918?
I don't think, to be honest, they were even given the opportunity to be outraged. The segregationist repression clamped down on them so hard from the moment they stepped off the boat back in the United States that they were just shoved back into the station that they had occupied before the war. 1919 alone saw 76 lynchings of African Americans in this country. And in the few years following the armistice, there were terrible, terrible riots in many cities throughout this country.
Did you talk about their feelings about returning to a life as a second-class citizen, the two African American vets that you talked to?
You know, I tried, but Moses Hardy, who was the only one of those two to go overseas, it wasn't in his nature, I think, to feel that kind of outrage. That may be one of the things that enabled him to live to the age of 113. I asked him at one point, how were you treated by your white officers? And he said, oh, it was great. There was no difference there, black, white. And I think he really meant it. In fact, toward the end of one of our conversations, I asked him, you know, a lot has changed in Mississippi for black people since you were growing up. Is it better now than it was then? And he looked at me and he said, I can't tell. Maybe not. Which was a really stunning thing to hear, but I think that was really just the person he was.
Now, a lot of people, when they reach a certain age, 100 and whatever, are asked, what is the secret to your longevity? Did you ask any of these people that?
Did every last one of them.
And then they all said, well, I smoked a cigarette every day and drank a pint of whiskey or something like that.
Different answers from every one of them. Many of them, something along the lines of, you know, don't sweat the small stuff. The first person I interviewed, Anthony Piero, who is an Italian immigrant, told me that if something bothers you, you better get rid of it as fast as you can. You know, a lot of people said, I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, I didn't chase women. You know, these are not very satisfying answers to hear. One man said bee pollen, which I actually tried and is very difficult.
Now, some of them had been injured in the war. You interviewed Corporal J. Lawrence Moffat, who was gassed in France. I would have thought that that would have shortened his life.
You would think so. And again, I think really emblematic of the people I interviewed. He was the second veteran I interviewed. And when I asked him about that, I said, were you ever gassed? He said, oh, yes, all the time. All the shells contain gas practically. And I looked at him for a second because if you know anything about World War I, you know about the terrible, terrible things that gas did to people. And I said, well, what was that like? And he just said, you know, I just lost my voice for a few days. I never went to medical for it or anything like that.
Well, he also was subjected to constant shelling.
That's right.
Did he describe what that was like?
He did describe what it was like. He talked about the sound the shells made and how you could tell after a while whether a shell coming in contained gas or not. But he also talked about the attitude he adopted that got him through it, which was a very fatalistic attitude. He said, look, if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. And he said to me, if I were dead, if I were killed, my problems would be over. I wouldn't know it. Other people might be upset by that, but not me.
I'm sure a lot of them were forced to philosophize because they survived when so many died. It was a devastating war. Didn't we lose more lives in that war than any other war?
Well, you know, it's a matter of proportion. We were only in that war for 19 months, and the first combat deaths didn't take place until November 1917. So if you think about it, in 12 months of fighting, we lost 117,000 men.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's twice the number we lost in Vietnam, for example.
That's right.
And Vietnam was a devastating war.
That lasted a decade.
Hmm.
Yeah.
My guest is Richard Rubin. His book, The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. We talked a bit about the women. We get an interesting perspective about life on the home front from Hildegard Chan, who was 107 years old when you talked to her. She worked in the War Department in Washington. Was she still considered a member of the military?
No, she was technically a civilian. But I told her story a little earlier about getting that telegram at 1 o'clock in the morning. You could certainly make a case that she was drafted.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the war, she worked with wounded veterans. How well were they taken care of by the government?
Not very well at all, unfortunately.
Well, nothing's changed, obviously.
There was no such thing back then as the GI Bill of Rights. That didn't exist until 1944 and was largely brought about because of agitation from World War I veterans who wanted better for their own children. She worked at the Veterans Bureau up on 34th Street and told me about seeing veterans come in, many who were missing a limb, and anything approximating a pension that they had was war risk insurance, which was totally optional. You didn't have to take that out. And if you took it out, it paid you a certain amount per month, and people would often borrow against that. And so next week they would come in, and there would be nothing. And this, she almost cried talking about it 85 years later.
Was she aware of what we now call PTSD, then called shell shock, and its impact on the vets that she worked with?
She was. She would have seen it every day. That, of course, wasn't even covered by war risk insurance. You had to have some ailment that was visible to the naked eye in order to claim something like that, yeah.
Well, America was already on the way to becoming the country it became, but World War I forced the transformation a lot quicker, didn't it?
Absolutely. Before that war, America was a regional power.
And had a largely rural society.
That's right. That's right. That war, to a great extent, urbanized America, to a great extent, it industrialized America. And it also brought America to a seat at the table of world powers for the first time.
Now, in collecting these stories, other than in reminding us that there were these people who went through this experience that's been largely forgotten, what else do you hope readers will take away with this book?
Well, I hope that they'll remember, first of all, that this war happened and that it was a very important part of making America the country that it is today. I hope it'll inspire us to sort of look at who is still around us and what we can learn from them. The last of the doughboys, as I write, are all gone now, and they're never coming back. But there are still a lot of people out there, those World War II veterans that gentleman talked about on the radio 10 years ago, Korean veterans, Vietnam veterans, people who have stories to tell about the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. We have a very, very rich history in this country that's contained in our people. But often as we go about our daily lives, we don't even see them. And I just hope that maybe people will walk around with a greater sense of the history that's all about us.
Well, there are any number of oral history projects, but they all seem to be sitting in the Library of Congress with nobody listening to the interviews.
That's true. There are a lot of them there. And there are programs underway that encourage people to go out with digital recorders and get the history around them. But I think we really need to take it up a couple of orders of magnitude.
Well, right now, as you said, we're losing a lot of veterans of World War II. They would be in their 90s or even close to 100. So it's important for somebody to start doing that right now as well.
That's right. I think fortunately for World War II, that's been going on for some time already.
Richard Rubin has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, Smithsonian, Parade, New York. His previous book, Confederacy of Silence, was a bestseller. Now we have The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's been a real pleasure.